Hey everybody, welcome back to what will prove, I hope, to be a gigantic show, a little bit of a weird show. We're gonna be mixing things up. So I'm John Adirola, Jared Jackson is here, and will continue to be here on this and all Wednesdays. But I will not be here for all of this Wednesday.
This and all Wednesdays. What is this the crack about last week because I wasn't here on a Wednesday? I was driving, John Adirola.
I was just driving. Making a promise that if people like you,
halfway across the country, I was driving with a 7-year-old in my backseat asking after 15 minutes, are we in Arizona yet?
Yeah.
No.
And you weren't because you wouldn't put the pedal to the metal. Anyway, but look, I'm going to be here for the first couple of blocks. A little bit later on the show, Brooke Thomas is going to be taking over because I have to go cover Bernie is speaking at a strike that's happening at UCLA a little bit later on today. So we want to do some live coverage of that. But before that, we're going to be talking about a lot. Bolsonaro, the fascist president of Brazil, visited the US. We'll be talking about him. A little bit later on the show, Brooke is going to be breaking down effectively a new poll tax in Florida, as well as the next move for Andrew Gillum. Got a lot of attention, a lot of hype in that last election, and now he has figured out what he's going to do with that. And a lot more to get to as well. Actually, in the next block, we're going to be talking with Philippe Nassif about the jailing of a female human rights attorney and activist in Iran. Getting a gigantic sentence for effectively no crime whatsoever. So we'll be breaking that down in just a little bit. But first, let's talk about what's been going on in the US. So yesterday, Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, one of the foremost fascists currently in elected office around the world, visited the US to meet with someone who would like to join those ranks. That's Donald Trump. And they talked about a number of different things. I want to show you just a section of Bolsonaro's remarks. And while you're watching this, also take note of Donald Trump's reaction.
Brazil and the United States stand side by side in their efforts to ensure liberties and respect to traditional family lifestyles, respect to God, our creator, against the gender ideology or the politically correct attitudes and against fake news.
Okay, so there you have Jair Bolsonaro, a guy who we might be reporting in 2 years has been mass jailing and torturing journalists. There's no reason to believe that that won't happen. Talking about fake news as dictators around the world have been doing since Donald Trump popularized and turned an actual word or phrase that meant something into whatever a dictator wants. And Donald Trump likes it. He's happy that Bolsonaro also uses that phrase. Another note, though, we're going to talk about the fake news. Donald Trump was kind of like his version of gravitas during that, but he did start nodding. And he started nodding when the reference to gender ideology came up, which we'll be talking about in just a minute. But first of all, overall reactions to these two buddies getting together.
This goes to exactly what we were always talking about when he was running. And I've gone back to it several times. It's because it continues to show itself. Whenever we talk about the characteristics of a president or a candidate at this point, and then we knew that foreign leaders, they had a specific playbook they had for Trump. They said, butter him up, say what he likes, act like you're his best friend. Have you heard, remember the best friend thing with Kim Jong-un and how that's worked out so far? And yeah, people have given Trump credit for trying to speak with Kim Jong-un. But then when talks fail, it's because his best friend line didn't pan out. It wasn't based on any kind of actual real life agenda or policy that you can actually implement. It turned into because we were best friends, we fell in love, and then the love affair fell apart, and now everything else fell apart. So these guys aren't dumb. They know what words to say and what to use and how to butter him up to put him in their right favor. So he's doing the same thing here.
Yeah.
Sure, he believes it as well, but he's like, oh, I can align myself with a guy who's thinking the same way I do, and then I can get some kind of favor with him. When you're electing a president and you point out these characteristics, it's not just for fun. It's because when he's actually in office and now he's been there for 2 years and he does things like this, he continues to legitimize horrible people that will allow them more cover to do what they've been doing.
Yeah. And look, I think, if you read between the lines, I think it's pretty clear why Donald Trump wants to get in better with Bolsonaro and why Bolsonaro cares about Donald Trump. There are a few things that they want to work together on. Bolsonaro wants to strip every tree from the Amazon and turn it into grazing land and all of that. That would be good for some corporations in Brazil and also for some gigantic corporations in the US as well. So they like that from a business perspective. Also, if Donald Trump decides to invade Venezuela, there's a reason to believe that Brazil might aid in that in some way. And Brazil wants access to US weapons. Donald Trump Trump today was talking about trying to add Brazil to NATO to make it easier to sell them weapons and work together militarily as well as economically. So I think that's what's really underlying it. But look at what they're willing to do to strengthen this relationship and keep Bolsonaro's hold of power in Brazil. He is going to scapegoat people, the same as Donald Trump, although not necessarily the same group. So in the case of Bolsonaro there, where he's talking about gender ideology, it's this idea that people who want their fundamental human rights to be recognized, members of the LGBT community, they're just pursuing an ideology like any others, and we don't have to respect it. And if we don't, maybe they don't deserve any rights. There's nothing fundamental, there's nothing deserving of respect. It's just an ideology. And these attacks are not just rhetorical from Bolsonaro, they have already had multiple effects on those communities inside of Brazil. So right off the bat, Bolsonaro's Minister of Women and Family, Damaris Alves, was recently quoted as saying, "Girls will be princesses and boys will be princes. There will be no more ideological indoctrination of children and teenagers in Brazil." So that's the Minister of Women and Family. The Minister of Education, Ricardo Velez Rodriguez, shut down a section of the ministry devoted to diversity and human rights. He has said he is against the discussion of gender theory, which centers gender identity in the classroom. So again, don't even study this stuff. Take it down. The new Minister of Women, Family and Human Rights also declined to add the LGBT community as a group explicitly protected by its mandate. Last month, the health official who headed the nation's HIV prevention task force was fired, apparently for authorizing a campaign aimed at educating transgender Brazilians. And here's the thing, like we had every reason to believe, we did multiple videos on the damage report specifically about various elements of why Bolsonaro is a disaster and will be a disaster if he became president. But we also saw it acting out in the months leading up to the election, where homophobic hate crimes in Brazil rose 75% in the few months leading up to that election. And now we're seeing it enacted in government policy in Brazil.
If you gave all these quotes and lines and policies off of many people within his inner working political circle and said this was an American official in the Trump administration, many ears wouldn't perk up and say, that sounds like another country. That doesn't sound like America. Because it's very similar policies and very similar approaches and meanings behind what people's general human rights are here.
Yeah.
So when guys in this, if other leaders do this and they're seen as the dictatorial nature of their policies and human rights violations policies that they do, we're supposed to seem different than that. But now it's all just meshing together because this is the way we approach our politics as well. These are the kind of folks that we have running the country. And then we're now proud of it just because of the name or the party behind it. This is what we have to snap out of.
Yeah, and we've been talking about Bolsonaro for some time now, and like I'm gonna read just a couple quotes. We've gone through so many, but him saying back in 2011, "I would be incapable of loving a homosexual son."
This was said by an American politician just last month or earlier this month.
Oh, that's true. That he'd see if they could swim. That's true. Yeah,
there is. All similar.
Yes. Also said that he would rather his son died in an accident than showed up with some bloke with a mustache. Also, by the way, just said I'm in favor of torture. You know that. So that's the leader. And to see him standing there with Donald Trump and to know based on multiple years of experience with Donald Trump right now, that if that guy was, you know, the centrist or center left leader of Canada or France or some other country, there's a chance that Donald Trump will hold them accountable for a number of different things. But if it's Duterte or if it's Un or if it's Bolsonaro, no, there's not going to be anything. There's going to be cooperation and mutual respect and understanding. That's what there's going to be. And to see them stand next to each other and to know how much they have in common ideologically, that is truly depressing.
And not trying to hide it. Usually you may think, oh, they have these things in common, but they're trying to hide it and make sure it doesn't look like he's right there shoulder to shoulder with someone like Bolsonaro.
Okay, so really briefly, I want to hear your perspective on this.
Yeah.
Steve King is still in elected office. He has defended white supremacy and white nationalism, which was one-tenth the scandal as Ilhan Omar's recent comments. And now he's dipping back into that well. He's asked a very simple question. Do you think a white society is superior to a non-white society? This is a woman, Mary Lavelle, who asked him that. And he said, I don't have an answer for that. That's so hypothetical. I'll say this, America is not a white society. It has never been a completely white society. We came here and joined the Native Americans. Man, yeah. Joined is doing a lot of work there. That word is being stretched to the snapping
really
point.
Joined.
There's words other than joined I would use. But he says, I don't have an answer for that. That's so hypothetical.
It's weird. He's had an answer for that in the past.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that hypothetical before when he said, you know, well, of course, he's using other terms. Western civilization has so much, is far superior than any other civilizations because of what the people that have come and created it did. He didn't say anything about joining Native Americans then.
Yeah.
Didn't say anything about, you know, other civilizations were thriving historically before this one started thriving. So this, in his mind, was the smart answer. He goes, mm-hmm. I'm getting ahead of this. They're not going to catch me on this anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that hopefully people can see through it, especially with his history of not just all the constant comments and tweets and speeches, but going and visiting anti-Semitic right. and white nationalist organizations, endorsing politicians that endorse this ideology and policies that would support it. I mean, look, he's been taken off of his committee assignments. I guess that's something. But the fact that, if Ilhan Omar said that about, I don't even know what the equivalent would be, but yeah. Something about Islam or something to drive the conservatives crazy. There would be serious talk about, oh, we got to get her out of there. Primary or instantly, Nancy Pelosi would be like, oh God, I don't know. What if she could ruin our chances in 2020?
You could assume a lot of things if they were asked about Islam. Is Islam and Christianity level, you know, playing field for religion? So I don't really have an answer to that. I'm
yeah.
not sure. Depends. Yeah. It's a hypothetical question.
And it's just, after a weekend of Donald Trump refusing to call out white nationalism, white supremacy, instead turning the conversation to literally anything. It could be Kate McKinnon or George Conway or whatever he wants to talk about, instead of actually taking this seriously, to see another elected politician on the Republican side effectively endorsing it by not denouncing the idea that there's an inherent superiority to a white society. How are you not scared about American government at this point?
It's easy to answer the question. It's easy to answer that question.
Yeah, it's relatively. You know what? It's not. Lots of different societies are awesome. Okay, so we're going to take a short break. We come back. Philippe Nassif is going to be joining us to talk about another basically attack against human rights inside of Iran and the legal implications of a development. We'll be talking about that after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
It's likely that you have not heard the name Nazrin Sotoudeh, but you should have, because this is a woman operating inside of Iran, a prominent Iranian human rights lawyer, defender of women's rights there, who for years has risked spending her life in jail to defend the rights of women to not wear hijabs and a number of other things. And as of this month, she has been sentenced to 33 additional years in prison for the work that she's done. And I want to break down how exactly we got to that point and what it represents for Iran. And joining us to help do that is Philippe Nassif. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you for having me, John. I appreciate it.
Very glad to have you on. And I originally read about this case actually from a report by Amnesty International. So thank you for your organization's work in this case as well. Before we get into the charges, can you tell us a little bit about Nazrin's career?
Great. So Nazrin is a very well-known human rights advocate and human rights defender in Iran. She is an activist that has been out front and open and very, very brave for many years when it comes to the issue of the rights of women, the rights of journalists, freedom of speech, freedom of expression in Iran. And many of these things are taboo topics. And if you are out front and advocating for changes to the right for women to be able to not wear the hijab, for example, or to be able to write and speak openly and freely about what it's like to be a woman in Iran, these are considered offensive by the government of Iran, by the theocracy, the theocratic government that runs the country. And what we see here is severe punishment being handed down to Nasreen after she was arrested last summer. And we're concerned about her plight. We're concerned about all of the women that are currently detained in Iran, over 100 of other women activists like Ms. Sotoudeh. And it's a big concern for Amnesty and for the human rights community.
And as you point out, she's already spent, it's getting on towards a year in prison, cut off from her family. Right. I mean, you talked about it being severe punishment, so let's talk about that. So what is the sentence that she is facing? And also, what are the charges that the Iranian prosecutors got her on?
Well, the Iranian prosecutors are, you know, they use a very archaic penal code that levies a variety of charges against women in particular, from prostitution to being outspoken about violating the hijab rule in Iran that is considered sacred by the theocratic government of the country. You know, this is a individual who has advocated for years that women should not be forced to wear a hijab. In Iran, if you are a woman, you have to wear head covering when you're out in public. And this is a woman who's been out front and open about how she does not feel like she should be forced and women should be forced to wear this hijab. So they hit her on that charge. So she's got 38 years in prison and over 120 lashes that she's going to be given, which is a brutal sentencing. And the judge went out of his way to give her the maximum penalty on all of the charges that have been levied against her. And it's horrific to see this sentencing. It's cruel. It's inhumane. And we're very concerned about the complete collapse in terms of the regard for the dignity of women like her. And human rights defenders in Iran. It's just getting worse and worse if you want to be a critic of the government and of its policies.
So considering her role as one of the foremost defenders of women's rights inside of Iran, do you think that this sentence is really, is it about her or is she being made an example of?
She's being made an example. It's not just about her, although they really fear her because she's an effective advocate. She has a big following in Iran. She's effective. They're terrified of women following in her example. Keep in mind, Iran is in a deep economic crisis right now. There have been a lot of protests. There's a lot of anger at the government in Iran for putting the lives of ordinary Iranians, reducing the quality of life, making it impossible for them to start businesses, get jobs, et cetera, et cetera. On top of that, you have a crackdown on the ability for Iranians to communicate, to engage on the web, on social media, access to information, being outspoken about issues like the hijab, for example. So there's a protest movement in Iran that is focused not just on some of the human rights conditions, but on the economic conditions. So this sentencing is a message to anybody that wants to cross the government of Iran: don't do it, or you will be lashed and you'll be thrown in jail, locked away, throw away the keys for over 30 years. So it's more than just the issues that she's raising, because there's a lot of anger in Iran right now, and the theocratic government is terrified of what will manifest out of this anger.
And so it sounds like what you're describing is that this is not some sort of outlier, but that this is part of a trend in the wrong direction in terms of the willingness of the regime to respect fundamental human rights or expand access or make the rights worth more in practice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is a trend. If you look at the trend lines in Iran, the Iranian regime has never been a champion of human rights, to say the least, okay? Both internally and externally in the region. We have seen a complete collapse with the regard for human rights conditions across the Middle East to begin with, especially the last several years, where a lot of these regimes feel like they're not going to be punished if they are punishing their citizens who are speaking out openly against them. So on top of that general trend of the countries of the region, from Saudi Arabia to Iran to Egypt, you've got the particular situation within Iran itself and the economic situation, the anger at the government, et cetera. This is a part of the reasoning for their sentencing. They want to make an example of her. They want to scare people from being outspoken and challenging the government on these issues. but they're going to fail because there are many, many others who are now not afraid to be out there, even with this kind of a sentencing, challenging the government because they feel like they have nothing to lose.
Is there anything that either the government or perhaps more realistically people watching the show can do to actually help the situation, to help get some justice for her?
I think that right now we in the United States don't have much leverage on Iran. We've sanctioned them, we're punishing them for a variety of reasons really unrelated to this particular case or even human rights conditions within Iran writ large. But I do think the average everyday American can be reaching out to their members of Congress to continue to talk about the human rights aspects of what's happening in Iran and across the region. But also in particular, our European counterparts. The EU does a lot of business with Iran. The EU is engaged in talking with the Iranian government. They have a little bit more leverage to pressure the government to release people like Nasreen and many of the other human rights defenders that are currently in prison and start respecting the average everyday individual who is trying to engage in public discussion about what it's like to live in Iran today. And I think that we have leverage there.
Hopefully. Philippe Nassif, Middle East Advocacy Manager for Amnesty International, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break. Actually, when we come back from this break, Brooke Thomas is going to be joining the show and taking the reins. Jared Jackson will be staying on. So lots more to get to after this.
Hey there, welcome back to The Damage Report. I am stepping in. I'm Brooke Thomas, stepping in for John, but please do not turn your screen off because John will be back tomorrow. This is just temporary, okay? Got a story, a couple stories out of Florida for you. First up, Florida lawmakers actually have advanced a bill that will limit the number of felons who can vote. Now, here are the details. This bill would require all felons to pay back court fees and fines before they can register to vote. And so we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars in total. Julie Evanson is with the ACLU, and she says what the barriers proposed in this bill do is nearly guarantee that people will miss election after election because they cannot afford to pay financial obligations, calling it an affront to Florida voters. This past November, you'll remember, Floridians voted to restore voting rights to certain felons, and many have already been registering. Now, what this bill will do is it will kick people off the rolls, some who have actually already been voting in recent local elections. Now, Evanson went on to say, keeping voters who can't afford to pay their fees immediately, keeping them disenfranchised for additional years, decades, or for the rest of their life is not what was contemplated by voters who passed this amendment. She says the financial obligation element of the bill that advanced Tuesday affects two groups: low-income felons who can't afford to pay back fees and those who committed property crimes and were sentenced to pay large sums of restitution and put on payment plans. Now, the measure also qualifies a slew of felonies with any kind of sexual component as a disqualifying sexual offense. That includes crimes like having an adult entertainment store too close to a school, as well as certain prostitution crimes. And finally, AOC jumped in on the combo, simply calling it a poll tax by any other name, with Public Citizen then jumping in and reminding us that Florida was the first state to adopt a poll tax. And they say this marks the GOP trying to become the first state to re-adopt one.
So we talk in history all the time about how far we've come in America.
Yeah.
Please stop complaining. You guys know what it was like in slavery times. You guys know what it was like in the civil rights era. Look how far we've come.
Right.
And we continue to see over and over again that all we've come in many elements is a new way to cover up and continue to do the same things we've always done. If you want to ask someone directly, any of these Republicans within this state legislator, what the reasoning is for this, for their implementation or their interpretation of what Amendment 4 was supposed to do, and you say, so is this a poll tax? They won't say it, but it's obviously what it is. So then I ask them next, so what's the reason for it? What do you need to do to keep these folks from voting? Because we already know it's all connected. The judicial system and the way we put many folks in prison and giving them fines that are disenfranchised because of their race or because of their background, their economic background. So we don't want those people voting. Why not? Don't you want to appeal to people who've then come out of prison and want to contribute to society? I thought this is in America. This is a place of opportunity, right?
Right.
So many times these folks come from communities that already get put down and given less opportunity. Then after they're thrown in jail for many times small types of crimes, they don't get a chance to then come out and get better jobs, contribute to society. So now they put with this extra fee. And keep in mind, this fee is not part of any kind of judgment from a judge. These are fees from court fees implemented by clerks and then added on to by creditors and debt collectors that now have percentages put on top of it of interest fees. This is absolutely planned to make sure no one else votes or certain folks don't vote because they don't want to have to deal with these people's decisions and agendas.
Right. It's like financial gerrymandering.
Absolutely.
Basically, I think, you know, people who commit felonies should pay their fines. That's part of your punishment. Mm-hmm. But should we be taking away someone's civil liberties because they can't pay a fine after already serving their time in prison? And I think also this kind of gives the idea that felons are just not paying their fines because they don't want to. They just don't want to. It kind of like ignores how hard it is to find a job when you're a convicted felon, a place to live, you know, many other things like that. Reasons a lot of times these people can't pay these fines.
They know this. This doesn't fall on they're not stupid. You know, there's no way they go, oh, I don't know how the system works. I'm only one of the legislators and I'm part of government. Right. They know how the system works and they know how to use it to their advantage.
All right, well, so on the other end of this, let's talk about Andrew Gillum, because today he is launching a massive voter registration group dedicated to taking down Trump. You'll remember he did lose the most recent race for governor of Florida by less than half a point. Meanwhile, the Florida Democratic Party says it will spend $2 million in the next year to register 200,000 voters ahead of next year's presidential primary. Florida Democratic Party Chairwoman Terry Rizzo said the party has not dedicated enough resources to registering voters in recent years. And there are currently 4.96 million registered Democrats in the state compared to 4.7 million Republicans and nearly 3.6 million voters with no party affiliation. Excuse me. And many people thought, and I think some were hoping, that Gillum would respond to the loss by running for president, kind of like Beto. Mm-hmm. But it seems his focus is getting more registered voters to the polls, which one could say is, you know, much more important.
This is the way, of course, you know, you always start from, I guess, as much local political change as you can, because mm-hmm. that's where it builds. Everyone focuses so much on the presidential race.
Right.
Oh, and the president's going to do this. So when the president is in office, he can't do everything, despite what our current president thinks and is attempting. They can't do everything. He's not going to go and change what's happening in Florida. So Andrew Gillum is in Florida. He's a Floridian. He's looking to change the problems there. Mm-hmm. And then once that happens, maybe there's some groundswell of people thinking, hey, I do have some level of control and power over what happens in my state. Maybe some citizens realize, hey, maybe my vote does count. We talked about the millions of voters that are there, either unregistered or unaffiliated.
Yes.
And you're not sure where their political leanings could be as long as you go out and reach out to them and tell them what their power is if they do vote.
I mean, then going back to the story we were just talking about, like especially in a time when their state lawmakers are trying to stop people from voting. All right, I have a little more on this. Of course, you know, we all know voting registration in Florida matters a lot. Of course, Trump's campaign already has its eye on Florida. And as Politico pointed out, if a Democrat can carry Florida in 2020, he or she could win the White House by capturing just one other swing state, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, or Pennsylvania. And that's if the remaining states voted the way they did in 2016.
You know who else knows that?
Who else
These
knows
folks
that?
That are trying to limit or to actually subvert the voting process that happened with Amendment 4 in the midterm elections. They know if there's any kind of change in the voting, what it could do for bigger elections like the White House. They know this. That's why they know how big Florida is and want to make sure it stays the way they want it to be.
And so it just kind of reminds me of how, like, Stacey Abrams kind of responded. We don't really know what everyone's doing as far as running for president. But, you know, she's spearheading that lawsuit challenging Georgia's elections and how they're run. Michael Bloomberg announced he's not going to run for president. A lot of people happy about that. And instead, he's going to fund a voter registration effort in multiple states. And it does kind of make me think what change could be made in Texas if the popularity that Beto O'Rourke has right. was put into getting more voters to the polls.
Yeah, or even, I'm not going to assume it's not going to happen. Or if your presidential aspirations don't pan out and you're from a state like Texas and your name happens to be Beto O'Rourke, then maybe you do take that new notoriety.
Right.
Because a lot of people run for president for notoriety. Let's keep it real. And many of them are like, okay, this is going to boost something else that I'm looking to do in my life. Once you have that boost, see what you can do and see how committed you actually are to the political process and advancing real agendas in America.
Yeah, better chances of winning many more races if that's where your efforts are, for sure.
If that's what we're looking for.
Yeah.
Because we know presidents without other support from other elements of the government actually a lot of times are handicapped. We saw it happen with President Obama. We have many complaints about the approaches he took when he did have the majority and also had control of Congress with the Democratic Party. And we saw how much worse it got once he lost that control.
I think I just can't stop thinking about how close all of these races were. And yeah, if the voters, you know, more voters on their side made it to the polls, the changes that could have been made just last November.
So we can complain about, you know, people in other aspects of office and how Congress never has a positive approval rating. But get people in office that you like, and you're gonna have positive approval ratings for people that are there. Look, and we know the types of characters that scare many of those in power, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We know the new folks that have come into Congress. If you fill it with those types of folks that are actually listening to the will of the people, maybe you might change some of the opinions.
Yeah. Okay, we have lots more to come on the Damage Report. John's here in spirit, I promise. Stay with us. Hey there, welcome back to the Damage Report. I'm Brooke Thomas, sitting here with J.R. Jackson.
J.R. Wednesdays.
Uh-huh, J.R. Wednesdays, absolutely.
What's the matter with
John
you?
Wednesdays, too. He's here in spirit. Okay, guys, I'm just filling in for him for a little bit today.
John won't be back.
We are joined by a special guest today. We have Terrell Jermaine Starr here. He's a senior reporter with The Root. And you, Terrell, good morning. Good afternoon. I guess it's afternoon on the East Coast, huh?
It is.
And so you've been covering the 2020 elections. You've had a couple big interviews that got a lot of attention. Your Kamala Harris interview got a ton of attention. I was actually waiting for it because kind of like the tease up to it. I want to just like jump right in to some things that you've been talking about, some answers you've been getting from candidates. And why don't we start with reparations? Because I remember I think it was a tweet, and you've said that Castro, Julian Castro, is the most devoted to the true definition of reparations. Can you explain that and maybe possibly where other candidates are getting it wrong?
Absolutely, and I should correct that. Actually, Marianne Williamson, who is also a candidate for president, she's actually even closer. And I think with Julian Castro, I guess more of the mainstream person who people feel has a closer shot. In that case, it would be Julian. And what I mean by that is many of the candidates have been pretty skittish early on about the conversation, but it's been activists that's been pushing it, pushing the discourse on it, basically specifically creating policy that aims to target Black people, right? And so it's not something in which we want reparations for Black people to end racism. It's more about paying a financial amount of money to Black people across the state for the travails of slavery. Now, we asked Kamala Harris about this, and she said that she was for it. Then she spoke to The Root and said, well, I'm not trying to do anything necessarily for Black people. So she gave a very different answer to The Real than she did to us. And I think with Cory Booker, he talked about baby bonds. And so you have a lot of people who seem to be afraid to take that on. But then you have Julian, who people consider to be a third or maybe second tier candidate. And what I'm looking for during this campaign season, as I talk to him and others, is if he's able to take economic justice and be more forward with it, he's probably going to have a greater shot than many people anticipate on Super Tuesday and the rest of the campaign. He could potentially be a sleeper if he keeps up being more specific about reparations and also other things that impact Black people directly, particularly with the wealth gap.
Terrell, this is JR. So when on the talk of like reparations, we've had all these with the field growing so much for the presidential, for the Democratic side, for the president. When they have to talk about reparations, there's always a concern that they're not coming off correct to the right voting block or coming off badly with another voting block. So they're trying to be very careful, which I think is why
they don't want to offend white people. Let's just say it, bro.
Yeah. So okay. So that's right. But they also don't want to lose the Black vote either, right? So do you think because of the identity of many of these candidates that they're looking to find where their niche is? Like, does Castro have an advantage because he's not the Black candidate or one of the Black candidates or seen as that? So is it easier to fit in, or maybe even as a Black candidate, it's easier to have your message said a certain way?
You know, that's actually a good question. During this particular cycle, I don't think any of that matters because you have the most diverse pool of candidates in presidential, Democratic primary history. And so you have to remember that the activist movement is really what's pushing this discourse. And so in 2016, this conversation wouldn't have taken place because candidates don't feel forced and compelled to do it. But actually go to 2018, where you have Stacey Abrams, you have Andrew Gillum, you have the AOCs, you have the Ayanna Pressley, Pressleys of the world, who are coming out being bold and Black and proud of it and winning on that and leaning into that. And so there is a way in which Black women in particular have been moving this conversation. And so you basically can't be a scared candidate anymore. This campaign cycle is not going to go for it, and particularly Black voters. And you have to really speak specifically to Black voters, because people are paying attention to Iowa, they're paying attention to New Hampshire, but if you don't win Super Tuesday and you don't get the majority of the Black vote or a strong percentage of it, you're not going to win, particularly Black women. And so if you know that, and Julian Castro does, and we know that based on his hiring of a Black woman to be his campaign manager, someone who has legitimate power. So it's not going to matter what your race is. What's going to matter is if you sound real or not, because we had Stacey Abrams, we had Andrew Gillum, people who we all felt that had they won their respective gubernatorial races, that they would be in the line for president, and they came out being authentically Black in themselves and being bold and being progressively Black. And so nobody's going to be able to get away with that. And if you're a candidate that's scared to talk about reparations, that's going to be a major mark on you.
Interesting. All right, Terrell, let's talk about Trump's use of ICE with Black immigrants, because I think sometimes we do have kind of like this narrow view of who is impacted by unfair immigration policies. And in kind of thinking about this and this question, I was reminded of 21 Savage and his detainment. Just it was last month, I think, by ICE, and out, and they called it a targeted operation. And outside of the PR tour immigration officials kind of went on regarding his arrest, it is a story that is pretty common with many Black immigrants. And it's just not something that I think we think about or are talking about as often. And I know you're working on something about this. And I was wondering, do you think things are worse under Trump?
Oh, far worse, mm-hmm. right? So the thing is that, the way that ICE is operated, even under former President Barack Obama, none of these administrations have been particularly kind to immigrants through ICE. So what makes the difference with Trump is that he's so openly racist and so openly direct and forward about targeting countries in which they're basically people of color, namely Eritrea, Guinea, Sierra Leone. Recently, Ghana, for example, right? You also have, Cambodia. In 2017, the Trump administration ordered visa restrictions against the countries I just named. And the excuse is that they were not adequately processing applications for deportation of their nationals from the United States to their respective countries. Now, if you speak to those respective countries that I named, Ghana, for example, they will tell you that, well, the U.S. has not given us the proper paperwork to prove that the people that they want to send to us are, in fact, our nationals. Huh. Now, the Advancement Project in Washington, D.C. recently filed a lawsuit against ICE, against the Department of State, among Department of Homeland Security, and among other departments, because they want specific information behind why individual people are being detained by ICE and being ordered to be deported. And so you have situations in which these deportation notices have been signed, but we don't know what type of crime the people may have broken or violated or not. And so it's just very arbitrary. And so the work that I'm going to be doing over the next few weeks we'll be discussing this lawsuit by the Advancement Project in Washington, D.C., but also exploring how these bans are impacting people who can't get visas to come to work, for example, over the United States. Also, people who are detained by ICE who don't necessarily have the right to representation during hearings or right to translators, et cetera. And so that, those are some of the things I'm doing. But it's a very arbitrary approach that this administration is taking place. And is it far worse? Yeah, most definitely.
Terrell, thank you so much for joining us today. Terrell Jermaine Starr, senior reporter with The Root. Looking out for your next piece. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, we will be right back with a little bit more for you. Hey there, welcome back to The Damage Report. I'm Brooke Thomas, filling in for John Adarola. I've got J.R. Jackson sitting next to me. We're gonna take it to New York because Stuyvesant High School in New York has a lot of people talking, and not in a good way, after only 7 black students were admitted to the school out of 895 spots. Now, Stuyvesant High School is one of 8 specialized public high schools in the city, and more than 4,800 black students took the exam to get into one of those 8. And here's kind of just like a stat to put things in perspective, okay? Black and Hispanic students make up more than 2/3 of the student body at New York public schools. But look at this picture of how many get into the specialized schools. Take a look at this chart here. So the black students are in the orange. These are the 8 specialized public high schools in New York City. Look at that. And so again, out of the probably the most popular, 895 spots recently. This is class of 2023, if you want to feel old. And they're 8th graders right now. 7. Schools Chancellor Richard Carranza said the 7 student admissions figure reflected bad news for the city's performance with students of color, saying we're also once again confronted by an unacceptable status quo at our specialized schools. Now, Mayor de Blasio has been trying to get, like, scrap the entrance exam process, but he's got to get approval from Albany to be able to do so.
So this is another example. The whole scandal came forward with rich folks paying for their rich kids that don't know anything to get into colleges
that they don't want to be in.
Parts, yeah, right. That they're absolutely unqualified to be in. If they took exams and exams were actually, factored into their decision process, many wouldn't get in. But we complain about how minorities are being placed in places they shouldn't be. And then it starts in the areas, I mean, from elementary school. We're talking about high school here.
Right.
From elementary school, children, as we've always seen in many studies, are placed in certain areas or treated certain ways or given certain opportunities that others aren't given just because of our perception of them. They're seen as older when trouble starts up. Like this 5-year-old they see as like a 9-year-old a lot of times whenever there's a trouble just because of their race and ethnicity. So in coming from this point of now being admitted into an opportunity, again, we keep talking about America. This is the land of opportunity. You come here, it doesn't matter what race, creed, nor whatever baby cradle you were pulled out of.
Bootstraps.
Doesn't matter. You can all make it.
Right.
No, but everyone doesn't believe that. People in power, administrators, admissions folks don't believe in this acceptance of an opportunity of America. So you can talk about all you want, but until we actually, that permeates society, it's not going to change. And it keeps getting proven over and over again from studies like this.
I mean, if diversity is important in New York City, this test isn't working, that exam process. All right, let's move on to just a ridiculous story for you. In defense of her argument that offering reparations to black Americans would actually make race relations worse, Fox News host Katie Pavlich made this ridiculous comment about slavery. Watch this.
They keep blaming America for the sin of slavery, but the truth is throughout human history, slavery has existed, and America came along as the first country to end it within 150 years. And we get no credit for that to move forward and try and make good on that.
Well, we did have a very bloody civil war.
Or over that
and
issue.
We also, and
the remnants are a long
of the racial history, and the remnants of the Civil War,
right.
Particularly blacks in the South,
correct.
Yes. That was not
and
an easy
and
path.
Still,
I mean, that was bloody and violent and deadly.
And there were Native Americans here when we showed up.
Yeah, my point is that we were the country
true.
That decided to end it, and we're still dealing with the issue. But if you want to start a problem and to inflame racial tension even more, start blaming people who have nothing to do with slavery for the sin of slavery. That is not fair. That's not the American way, and we shouldn't be doing it.
I'm just wondering, does Harris Faulkner get hazard pay for having to sit through conversations like that?
She's had to do it so many times, and sometimes I look at her face and I'm wondering, is she rethinking
her? Wait, are
you
okay?
Right. She's going, okay, I can't wait to get home because there's a nice bathtub I'd like to get in and just forget my day. So, going on to what Katie Pavlich said here, Okay, we're getting credit for
so
ending.
So many reasons, Cecil,
okay,
we didn't even have enough time.
I was a career-long bank robber, and one day the police caught me and sent me to jail. You know, give me credit for stop robbing banks.
Right.
Hey, they stopped you. You didn't do it on your own. There's still people in the South right now that reenact Civil War battles hoping that the South had won.
People get married on plantations. It's horrible.
Do a plantation tour and see how happy they are to talk about what
all
used
right.
to go on there.
That's all for the Damage Report today. John will be back tomorrow. Thank you so much for watching.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.